Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 9, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we'll be discussing the Gloucester County Supreme Court case concerning the Department of Education interpretation of Title IX as it applies to transgender students. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest Kyle Duncan. He's a partner at the Sher Duncan Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. Among other things, the firm represents the school board in this case, and they have filed a brief in the case. The other side has not yet, so I understand in this litigation update there might be some limitations in what our expert can tell us. But he's going to give us some opening remarks, then we'll, as always, be turning to the audience for questions. So with that, Mr. Duncan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. This case involves the longstanding allowance under Title IX and its regulations of sex-separated restrooms and other facilities such as locker rooms and showers. In the decision below, the Fourth Circuit relied on an unpublished opinion letter from the Department of Education to determine that students must be allowed to use separated restrooms corresponding to their gender identity instead of their physiological sex, the gender identity meaning a student's innate sense of being a male or a female apart from the sex they were, quote, assigned at birth. And for that reason, the Fourth Circuit invalidated the school board's policy, which is my client, that provided separated restrooms by biological sex. The facts of the case are fairly simple, and I'll go through them quickly. The case involves a high school student at Gloucester High School in Gloucester County, Virginia. The student is known by the initials GG. The student was born female, but GG identifies as a male. And so when GG was allowed for a short period of time to use the boys' room at the high school by the principal, parents and students began to complain that this constituted an invasion of student privacy. And for that reason, the board adopted a new policy, or I should say adopted a policy that the board believed had always been in place, but it just decided to put it down in writing, that restrooms and locker rooms were to be designated for use by students according to their biological sex. At the same time, the high school has provided three single-user unisex restrooms for the use of any student who desires greater privacy. Soon after the board adopted this policy, a mid-level official in the Department of Education issued an informal letter, in response to an inquiry about the board's policy. And in that letter, the official opined that with respect to transgender students, Title IX requires them to be allowed to use restrooms and other facilities according to their gender identity, regardless of their physiological sex. GG then sued in federal court, sued my client, the Gloucester County School Board, under Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause. In the district court, without ruling on the Equal Protection claim, the district court dismissed GG's Title IX claim based on, as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, the longstanding Title IX regulation that expressly provides that Title IX funding recipients can provide restrooms and other facilities separated on the basis of sex. The district court believed that that regulation foreclosed GG's Title IX claim. And additionally, the district court refused to accord any kind of administrative deference to the DOE letter that was issued shortly after the board adopted its policy. Specifically, the district court decided not to accord any deference under the Supreme Court's decision in Auer versus Robbins to the DOE letter. On appeal to the Fourth Circuit, a split panel of the Fourth Circuit reversed. The Fourth Circuit held that Auer deference should have been granted to the DOE letter. Specifically, the the court should have given controlling weight to the mid-level official's opinion that students should be allowed to use sex-separated restrooms and other facilities according to their gender identity. And for that reason, the Fourth Circuit ruled that the board's policy was invalid under Title IX, and it remanded. And at that point, the district court immediately entered a preliminary injunction against the school board. At that point, the school board applied for an emergency stay from Chief Justice Roberts. The Chief Justice referred the application to the full court, which stayed the Fourth Circuit's mandate. And then subsequently, the Supreme Court granted certiorari in the case on two questions. The first one was the doctrine of Auer versus Robbins properly applied in this case? And the second was, regardless of whether Auer deference should have applied, was the underlying interpretation of Title IX and the regulation correct? Now, I'll just say a few words about the arguments in our brief, but very briefly so we can proceed to questions. Our brief, which we filed recently, considers the meaning of Title IX and its regulation first, and the question of Auer deference second. We do that for two reasons, as we explain in the brief. First, it's much easier to understand why Auer never should have applied in this case if one understands the Title IX regulatory structure concerning sex-separated facilities. And secondly, I think everyone realizes that with a new administration coming in on January 20th, there is the possibility that the regulatory guidance may be changed or even rescinded. We don't know if that's going to happen, of course. But if it does, we believe that this still leaves the merits question, and so we decided to brief that first. Now, just a few words about the merits question. Our argument is that the Title IX regulation issue plainly permits the board's policy of providing sex-separated restrooms, but the interpretation adopted by the Fourth Circuit would essentially equate the idea of sex under the regulation with one's gender identity to the exclusion of one's physiology. We argue that that interpretation is definitively foreclosed by Title IX. We look at dictionaries contemporaneous with Title IX that overwhelmingly define sex by physiological characteristics. We look at Title IX's legislative history that plainly envisioned sex-separated facilities for the purpose of preserving privacy. We also look at Title IX's structure, which, if one replaced sex with the concept of gender identity, would lead to all sorts of administrative problems with Title IX. It would also lead to having other legal problems arise under Title IX, such as creating hostile environments for other students by allowing the opposite sex into intimate private facilities, and it would allow to, frankly, absurd problems in the field of athletics, which Title IX also governs. Independently, we also argue that this interpretation accepted by the Fourth Circuit would cause Title IX to violate the spending clause by imposing a condition on funding that no funding recipient could have had clear notice of. Then, very briefly, my comments are very brief. The brief then goes on to the question of Auer deference, and we make three basic arguments about why Auer should not have applied. First, the DOE letter is really interpreting the statute and not the regulation, which removes the whole premise for applying Auer under the Supreme Court's decision in Gonzales versus Oregon. Secondly, we argue that the regulatory language, even assuming that it's being interpreted by the opinion letter, the regulatory language isn't ambiguous about whether sex-separated facilities are allowed. We argue that they unambiguously are allowed and that the interpretation taken by the DOE letter is not a permissible interpretation under the text, history, and structure of Title IX. And then finally, we argue that that an opinion, a letter such as the one in this case that doesn't observe any of the procedural requirements for acting with the force of law, such as notice and comment and similar procedures, because the letter didn't do that, it shouldn't be given binding legal force under Auer, just as a letter that failed to follow these kind of procedural requirements would not be giving binding force under Chevron. And so those are our arguments. for both under the merits and also under the hour question. And with that, I turn it over to Dean and look forward to your questions.
Terrific. Thank you so much. In a moment, let's open the floor to questions. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. A reminder, this is a case in litigation, and it's clear from the opening remarks, so our guest might be limited in what he can say in response to questions. But let me get us started here. You mentioned, Mr. Duncan, you alluded to the notion that, maybe the underlying facts could change here in a new administration. Maybe the guidance document would be changed or maybe altogether withdrawn. Can you say a little bit more about what happens in the case if that takes place?
Sure. I mean, this is a question that comes up often, and we address it in our brief. I mean, I think it's obvious that when you have a case like this where the Court of Appeals decision addresses an informal agency position, in this case, a letter that came from, as I said earlier, that came from a mid-level agency official. It was, frankly, as we talk about in our brief, the letter was written in response to an inquiry by a lawyer about this very board policy from our client. And in response, you get this, you know, two or three page letter, I forget how long it is, that opines about how Title IX may apply in this situation. It's quite an informal letter. We all recognize that with a different administration, the letter could be rescinded in some way. There could be new guidance issued. And I should mention that not too long after this letter issued, the Departments of Education and the Department of Justice issued I won't say a more formal letter, but just sort of a more elaborate letter called the Dear Colleague Letter, that took what the first letter did and sort of expanded it. And that letter, as I think we'll talk about later, is also the subject of litigation by a number of states. But in any event, a new administration can come in and change it. Now, we, in all frankness, we have no idea if the new administration is going to change it or what it's going to do, if anything. But we have to allow for that possibility. Now, when we sought cert in the case, we sought cert on multiple questions, and the court granted two of them. The last question the court granted, as we briefed it in our cert petition, addresses the underlying interpretation of Title IX in the regulation. In other words, let's take deference off the table altogether. Is the interpretation in the letter correct? We asked for cert on that question, and the court didn't have to grant it, but it did. And so what we're saying in our opening brief is we're building in the possibility that there could be some change to the guidance document. And if there is, we're asking the court to proceed to the underlying merits question. Now, of course, the court doesn't have to do that. It can do whatever it likes. But we think we've provided good reasons for why the court ought to do that if there's any change in the regulatory guidance.
Terrific. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll take questions in just a minute. You mentioned in your answer just now litigation in other states. I wonder if you could maybe give us just a quick update on those and indicate how your case might or might not interact with the other cases.
Sure, Dean. This area of litigation, as some of the listeners may be aware, has become extraordinarily complicated in a very short amount of time. I guess, taken in chronological order, the state of North Carolina, who we also represent, had passed earlier in 2016 a law that is similar. It's not exactly the same, but it's similar to the board policy at issue in Gloucester County. This is the HB2 law in North Carolina that also requires bathrooms and other similar facilities to be separated by physiological sex. That law has been under attack by both private parties represented by the ACLU and also by the United States Justice Department for a large chunk of 2016. And that litigation, which has gotten fairly large and complex, was proceeding at a pretty fair clip until the Supreme Court acted in Gloucester County. The first thing that happened was when the Supreme Court stayed the Fourth Circuit's decision, the North Carolina litigation was postponed, the trial date was postponed. Then when the Supreme Court granted Gloucester County, granted the cert petition, the trial was for all intents and purposes stayed, which is where it is right now. So it's being stayed pending what happens in Gloucester County. I should mention, though, that there is an interlocutory appeal by the plaintiffs in one of those North Carolina cases that is in the Fourth Circuit that addresses some of the issues that the Supreme Court will address in the Gloucester County case, albeit that's an equal protection appeal and not a Title IX appeal. So, you know, I think everyone recognizes in the North Carolina case that what the Supreme Court does, you know, and what extent it addresses all the issues in Gloucester County may well impact what happens in North Carolina going forward. So that's a very important possible side effect of the Gloucester County case. Texas and a number of other states, I forget how many, challenged the follow-up guidance from the DOE and the DOJ. This is the so-called Dear Colleague letter that elaborated on what DOE had done in the Gloucester County case. That was challenged on various grounds by Texas and a number of other states, and I believe there's also a case in Nebraska that challenges the same guidance by some other states. The district judge in the Texas case issued a more or less a nationwide injunction against the Dear Colleague letter. It didn't have an effect on the North Carolina case because of some provisos in the injunction, but it was a fairly dramatic development when the judge enjoined the Dear Colleague letter. And as I understand it, that case is now up in the Fifth Circuit. I don't know where briefing is on the case. And I don't know if the court has set argument. I doubt it has, but I don't know that. So the Gloucester County case, depending upon what issues it raises, could have a dramatic effect on the Texas case. And you know, as could any change in the Dear Colleague letter by the new administration. So this case is obviously not limited to the parties in the Gloucester County case, which may well be one reason why the Supreme Court took the case.
Very good. If you have a question in the audience, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We'll start with one question. I fear I might have scared some of our audience off with my warnings about limitations in answers, but let's take our first call now.
Okay. Oh, good afternoon. My name is Lewis Smith. I'm not a lawyer, but I do have a couple of questions. First of all, does an unpublished guidance letter, or a published guidance letter for that matter, have any legal effect in any federal court or Supreme Court?
Well, let me take that. If you have a follow-up question, I can take that as well. But let me just take that one because that really gets to the heart of one of the issues in GG. I mean, you say you're not a lawyer, and I think it's fair to point out that to normal people who are not lawyers, I think they would be surprised that an official in an agency simply writing a letter.
Yeah, that is something that worries me. I'm definitely a federalist, and I think some of these agencies have gotten far beyond their legal or their legal right to issue anything.
Well, we certainly agree, and those are some of the arguments we're making in this case. But when you have an agency, an official in an agency that writes a letter that doesn't even go through, let's say, notice and comment proceedings. It doesn't get the input of any of the public on these issues. And this letter, despite the fact that it's a short letter from a mid-level official in the agency, is rendering an opinion on a very, very divisive topic that has potentially huge impacts on recipients of federal education dollars under Title IX.
Yeah, exactly.
And so a normal person would think, well, at a minimum, a court might consider this a kind of letter in interpreting Title IX and its regulations for itself. It might say, well, maybe the agency has some expertise in this issue and give it a little weight. But in this case, the Fourth Circuit applied a doctrine of from the Supreme Court called Auer versus Robbins, as I talked about earlier, and that gives the letter controlling weight. That's the term that the Fourth Circuit used, meaning that the Fourth Circuit didn't even the Fourth Circuit suggested that the interpretation of Title IX and the reg and the letter was somewhat novel. But it really didn't think that it had the authority to go and interpret the regulation and the statute for itself. And one might say that that is essentially that disposition basically cedes to the agency the power to write a regulation and the power to interpret the regulation, which is an obvious violation of separation of powers. And so we think it's very problematic. And we think that if the Supreme Court does address the Auer issue in this case, we have a very strong case that this opinion letter should never have been given controlling weight. That instead it should be the courts that determine what the law is.
Right, exactly. The other question in that regard was: is that the Auer, H-O-U-R, or
A-U-E-R.
A-U-E-R. Okay.
Auer, right. Auer versus Robbins. That's just the case that gave the doctrine its name. It's actually a doctrine that goes way back to the 1940s.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Even before the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, was adopted by Congress. And the extent and the contours of the doctrine are pretty hotly contested. Some justices, including the late Justice Scalia, called for the entire doctrine to be thrown out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. The other question I had is more of a rhetorical question, in the Federalist Papers and elsewhere, they speak of the rule of the majority. And in this case, another cases similar to this, I think that it's the minority is speaking for everybody, and I just wonder what's happened to the rule of the majority.
Well, since it's a rhetorical question, I won't tell you what I think, but I think
I know
you probably infer it from what I've said so far.
Thank you. Sure. Yeah. All right. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate it, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Looks like we do have another call from the audience. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Now let's take another call. Caller, you might have muted your own phone. If you've muted your phone, you need to come off mute.
You mean Kyle? I'm
okay.
Go ahead. Okay, we can hear you.
Yes, thank you. Kyle, this is Matthew Kaczmarek at First Liberty Institute in Dallas, Texas, and we do plan to file an amicus brief in support of the petitioner in this case. And I wondered if... Yes, and on behalf of some religious colleges and schools and organizations who have an interest in Title IX policy in the rulemaking process, I thought it might be helpful to any parents or those interested in private and parochial education to understand sort of the administrative law angle. If you are a parent or a headmaster of a school that is not a public school, why should you care in this case? Why should you care about this case, and why should you care about the Administrative Procedures Act?
Good question. Title IX applies, of course, not only to public schools, but to any school that accepts federal funding. Now, I'm not aware of the percentage of schools in this country, public and private, that are subject to Title IX, but I have to think that it's a very, very high percentage. So when a court, or in this case an agency, administrative agency, tells us what Title IX requires of funding recipients, in other words, if you get the money, these are the strings that are attached to it, that has a major impact on the school that receives the funding. The only way to get out of those would be to not take the money, which might have dramatic impacts on schools. And so that's one reason why everybody should care about this case. With respect to the Administrative Procedure Act, this is a very important statute that has been around for decades, 70 years probably, I don't know how many years, but it's a procedural framework for how administrative agencies act that governs, that makes sure they act with, according to the rule of law. And in particular, when they adopt an interpretation of a statute that they administer, such as Title IX, at a minimum, they're supposed to allow public comment and input on changes to the way they administer regulations. That's a minimum for what should be required when there's a change in substantive requirements under Title IX. I'm speaking very broadly here. There's all kind of nuances here, but I think that's fair to say that the public would want to be able to comment on something as dramatic as this, for example, where an administrative agency says, well, here's how schools are going to have to deal with students who say, I was born a female, but I identify as a male, and so therefore I ought to be able to use, let's say, the male locker room or the male shower facility, or be allowed onto a male sports team, or be allowed to be in a living facility reserved for males only. If an agency is proposing to interpret Title IX and upset the settled expectations of schools around the country that have been settled for years, at a minimum, people ought to be able to have input into that. That's sort of, I think, what the minimum requirement is under the Administrative Procedure Act. And as we know, in this case, this interpretation comes purely out of the opinion of one official in the Department of Education. Now, to be fair, there are other people in the Department of Education and the Department of Justice who have taken this view of Title IX, but this view has never been subject to public comment. It's obviously never been subject to Congress's views. And the real irony, I think, here is that on numerous occasions, Congress has considered bills that would insert the concept of gender identity discrimination into a whole raft of different laws. And Congress has pretty consistently rejected that. And yet here, you have one official who inserts that concept into one of the most important federal education statutes that we know of, Title IX, does it without any input from the public, and all of a sudden a circuit court declares that it's the controlling interpretation of Title IX for every school district in the Fourth Circuit. And then the department comes out with this Dear Colleague letter soon after that tries to project that onto every school in the country. And so I think what we have here is a pretty dramatic breakdown in representational government, which, again, I think is one reason why the Supreme Court took this case instead of allowing the issue to percolate further. I don't know.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you, Kyle, because I know a lot of parents have children in private and parochial schools, and they think they're somehow unaffected by the Title IX reasoning in this case, or the Ferg-Kadima letter that's at the root of it. But what starts at the Department of Education and trickles through Title IX does ultimately impact the free exercise and the free speech interest of private and parochial schools because of the funding stream. And I wanted to flag that issue for people who may not otherwise have interest in tracking, you know, administrative law or education law matters in this context. If you have your kids at a private and parochial school, you might make the mistake of thinking you're going to remain unaffected, but that's likely not true given the breadth and reach of the Department of Education and Title IX.
That's right. Thanks.
Our lines are wide open at this point. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple more questions now, so let's proceed through the queue.
Hi, my name is Betsy Clark, and I was just wondering how hard it would be for Congress to rein in the agency and pass some sort of either resolution or law saying that the Department of Education does not have the authority to define, allow people to define their sex subjectively.
Well, that's a great question. My first answer is that Congress already did that, quite frankly, when it passed Title IX in the mid-70s. And then the agencies, it was HEW then, it wasn't the Department of Education, the agencies promulgated this regulation. Our brief looks very carefully at the legislative history, and we found no surprises in the legislative history. If anything, we found that it was crystal clear that everybody understood that they were talking about physiological distinctions between men and women when you're talking about the concept of sex. And it was obvious that when you had senators and representatives who were saying, but of course, this doesn't mean that we're going to have to abolish separate living facilities for the different sexes, because that would be ridiculous. And of course, everyone agreed with that. And the statute, not just the regs, but the statute specifically allows the separation of living facilities by sex. So my first answer is Congress already did this. And what you have here is, quite frankly, just advocates for a particular ideological position in a position of power in an agency who set about changing the definitions in the law to suit their own proclivities. That's what's happened in this case. Certainly Congress could come back and, you know, I guess make it even more abundantly clear by using the term physiological sex or biological mm-hmm. sex. It could do that. But as I said at the beginning of the call, the agency under a different administration could clarify this, could, for example, and I'm not a member of the new administration, so this is just me talking, lawyer for the school board. But it would seem to me to be very easy for a new administration to clarify that what the DOE and DOJ have been interpreting Title IX to mean over the last couple of years is absolutely contrary to what the law says on its face and what was intended when the law was enacted. So they could absolutely do that. It wouldn't take Congress doing it, although, you know, Congress could certainly do it. So there's any number of ways that Congress or the agencies could clarify this. And, you know, just to be fair, you know, if this is an important issue to people on the other side, because I can imagine people saying on the other side, well, no, you're ignoring a real problem for transgender people. Well, fine. If there's a real problem in the way Title IX applies, then at a minimum, let's go through a notice and comment proceeding so that people could have input on how the regulations need to be changed. Or if it requires a statutory fix, then let's have a debate about it in Congress about how it needs to apply. Because there are strong opinions on either side of this. You'll hear the other side in these cases, and I'm sure they'll say it in their brief, that there is a medical consensus about these sorts of transgender and gender identity issues. And that's just, you know, as I think many of our amici will very likely say, and as we've already said in the North Carolina litigation, that's just not true.
Right.
There is a debate about what this is and how it should be addressed. And the most important point for our purposes here is that when you have a situation like this that arises, that is a novel situation, the law has to be very careful about how it addresses it. It has to do it through the normal legislative and administrative processes. You don't do it through a mid-level official writing a letter. That strikes me as the worst way to do it, the way sort of calculated to make sure that it inflames the issue as much as possible, which is what's happened here. That's why you have, 20-something states suing the current administration over these kinds of administrative sleights of hand that we see going on here. So I think this is real administrative overreaching here, and I think you're going to see it shut down. That's my hope.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let me ask a question before we go to our next caller, though. I take it that if the incoming administration undoes this by an administrative rule or withdraws the current guidance, a subsequent administration then could, even if it's administrative overreach, could do again what the previous administration had done, that is reverse the field. And yet if Congress acts, then it would take if Congress acts again, I guess it would take a congressional act to overrule Congress. It's something of a muddle in the question there, but I think you get what I'm asking.
No, I get it. It's a great question. I get exactly what you're saying, Dean. Let me say it this way. The position that we have consistently taken in this case is that a mere agency opinion letter or an agency guidance document is not enough, not remotely enough, to address this kind of dramatic change in what Title IX means. It's not clear. In other words, let me give you a concrete example. When the statute came out, Title IX came out in the mid-70s, there's a provision in it that says you can provide separate living facilities on the basis of sex. Now, at the time, one of the agencies charged with implementing Title IX, HEW, promulgated rules fleshing out what living facilities means. Well, that seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. What is a living facility? What kind of facilities does it apply to? Same thing with sports teams. If Title IX is going to apply to sports teams, how is it going to apply? I could see a field for administrative interpretations there. But to reinterpret the very concept of sex in Title IX, that's just rewriting the statute. And no administration, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat administration, Trump administration, Clinton administration, Obama, Bush, whoever, Roosevelt, it doesn't matter. Administrations, agencies shouldn't be able to rewrite the basic parameters of a major statute. I mean, that's just civics 101. So I think your point is extremely well taken, that this is not just some sort of partisan game where the Obama administration hits the tennis ball over the net to the Trump administration, and they come up with their own interpretation of what Title IX means. From my perspective, and I think I'm from my client's perspective as well, in this litigation, that's not the way this should work.
We do have one question pending from our audience, so let's take another call.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Maine. Not an attorney, but goodness, for such schools as Hillsdale and Grove City, there ought to be many more of them. One of the things I feared when Bush wanted to work through the churches to counter poverty and such was that the churches would become compromised. Certainly the states have become compromised by their acceptance of federal funds. But my real question is there any precedent for a letter such as this to be accepted as dispositive of an interpretation of a statute?
It's a great question. And I'm glad to hear a question from Maine because I spent a lot of time there last summer with my family, and it's a great place. But that's not pertinent to your question. One of the first questions that was asked went to this as well, which is this whole doctrine of our versus Robin's deference is problematic. Because interpreted wrongly and interpreted too broadly, I think, applied too broadly, the doctrine allows sort of the doctrine allows expressions of opinions by administrative agencies to somehow be clothed with the force of law. And that's a real problem. You see it, but to answer your question more directly, I mean, I don't know that you have a case that specifically has a letter this informal that is given the force of law in a case like this. I mean, you do have cases, and I think this was actually the original Auer versus Robbins case that involves an amicus brief, meaning a friend of the court brief filed by an agency or filed by the Justice Department. And the court will defer to it. So there is room in Auer for the court to defer to things like a legal brief. But I think pushed too far, you get into the problem of clothing with the force of law these pronouncements from agencies that aren't vetted by anybody except the agency itself. And I think it's really problematic. Just to be perfectly clear, one of the questions we asked the court to grant cert on was whether the entire doctrine should be thrown out, should be overruled, as Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas have called for. The court did not grant cert on that question. So, whether or not, I don't know if the court is interested in that question. It's obviously not interested in that question in this particular case because it didn't grant cert. But by the same token, the court may well be interested in sort of refining this whole doctrine so that you don't have this situation arise again where an informal, unvetted opinion letter suddenly becomes the same thing as a statute.
I fear we're logically headed for omni-sex sports where there'll be one hockey team, anybody, no matter what your sex, gender, whatever you want to call it, can join it and just get rid totally of the male-female type of designations.
Well, you may be right, but that, of course, would violate what Title IX says, which is, yes, you should have equal opportunity for the two sexes to participate in sports teams, but Title IX specifically recognizes sex that you can have sex-separated teams, especially, and I think the language of the statute is especially where you have sports involving bodily contact. So it's clearly what the framers of Title IX were interested in, were thinking about, were the physiological distinctions between men and women, something that has been taken for granted for a long time, and now litigation like this is forcing the courts to recognize it. And I certainly hope they do, because I think it's the right way to interpret the law.
What the law says seems to have less and less to do with how it's pronounced by the courts.
That's a problem.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, we still got a few minutes left. We're prepared to go to quarter after the hour. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, I'll make an observation that I've seen from my perch, and that is that with regard to these guidance letters and informal rulemaking, the practical effect on the regulated community is that law is being made, or policy at least is being made, and that there's you comply or you don't comply at your own risk. And if the agency you're always subject to an enforcement action or a reduction in funds or something like that. So the practical effect can often be a rule that you must comply with. Kyle Duncan, I don't see a final question, or perhaps we've had our final question is a better way to say it. Let me give you a minute or two to express any final thoughts and wrap up. Before you do that, I'm sorry, we do have one more question.
Oh,
so since we have some time, let's take another call. Go ahead, caller. We cannot hear you. You might have your telephone muted. If your phone is muted, you need to come off mute.
Yes, Kyle, could you speak to a lot of the case law you see in Title VII and Title IX that say that sex and gender are interchangeable? You see that a lot in the DOJ briefing. You see that in seminal rulings from the EEOC like Macy versus Holder and Baldwin versus Fox. They'll string cite and say sex and gender were interchangeable terms, so sex, gender, and gender identity are interchangeable as this statute is applied.
Well, that's a very good question. It's a complicated question, but let me just hit a couple of high points there. I think when you see DOJ or DOE making those kind of legal arguments, they're deeply, deeply misleading. We don't have time to go through all the cases right now, but for example, you do have a number of cases out there that involve a quote-unquote transgender person who is making a claim of sex discrimination under Title VII. And so you'll say, and I've read all these cases, you'll have a person who decides, okay, look, I was born a man, but I'm actually a woman, and so I'm going to go through a transition process, and I'm going to, maybe alter my body through hormones or even surgery. I'm going to alter my appearance and this sort of thing. Now, a person in that situation, it's still protected by Title VII. Nobody's saying that that person suddenly takes him or herself outside the confines of Title VII. If an employer, I want to be careful about not, opining on hypothetical cases, but if an employer says to that person, hey, I don't like your appearance anymore, I'm firing you, and that person sues under a sex discrimination theory under Title VII, there are courts that go both ways on whether that's a valid claim under Title VII. But I think the important point here is when DOJ cites those cases and says, therefore, sex means gender identity and a man who identifies as a woman can use the woman's bathroom, that's just bad use of precedent. Those two cases are nothing alike. I would go further than that and say, let's assume that the transgender person who's going through this transition does have a valid, let's call it a sex stereotyping claim. That's what you see a lot of in these cases. You see transgender people saying that you discriminated against me in my employment. You fired me because I don't look enough like a man. I look too much like a woman, and so you're stereotyping, and so you've fired me. Let's assume that that's a valid claim. I'm not saying I agree that that's a valid claim. Let's assume that's a valid claim. What you have going on in these bathroom and locker room cases is exactly the opposite of what's going on in the Title VII cases. And let me explain. This is difficult for a lot of people to grasp, but I think it's really important. The law, like the policy adopted by my client or the North Carolina law, is the opposite of sex stereotyping. Those laws and policies are saying, if you're a biological male, you're going to use these facilities for basic privacy reasons. We don't care whether you look like a woman, whether you identify like a woman. We don't care about that. We want you to use these facilities according to biology because they are separated for physiological reasons. That is the opposite of sex stereotyping. And we're making that argument in our brief here because we expect to see these sex stereotyping cases. I can't go through all these cases right now, but I think it's very important to recognize that when the Justice Department or private groups are saying this question has been settled by other cases under Title VII, that's wrong. They are misusing that precedent. There are cases out there that I hope raise those questions, that I know raise those questions, that I hope get to the Supreme Court. It's a good question you asked, but it's sort of
Kyle, the reason Yeah, the Kyle, reason I raise it because I used to work in the private sector, and I know there are compliance officers who put out memoranda on these subjects, and you'll see this Price Waterhouse sex stereotyping reference that this category is settled simply because Congress and some landmark decisions use the term sex and gender interchangeably. That's true, but they were using that terminology always as a synonym for the binary biological difference between male and female. You can't glom onto that a new definition that didn't even exist as a legal concept when those cases were decided. But they're getting away with magic word briefing,
yeah.
And a lot of people who do not do the work of reading the actual opinions and writing down the syllogism will fall for that, you know, right side
yeah.
of history.
No, you're right, Matthew. That's an even worse argument, frankly. I guess I was giving him too much credit. Sure, the term gender gets lumped in with sex, and I think it's inexact, and I don't think it should be done. But sure, the Supreme Court's been doing that for years. But that doesn't mean that sex equals gender identity. The way that the term gender identity is being used in these cases is one's internal perception of oneself as a man or a woman, completely apart from one's physiology. That's really, really important. We're very careful in our brief to use what the other side says that their claims are with respect to gender identity. That is a huge step beyond sex and gender as it's been used in cases. That is a terrible argument. And I think it's very, very important to do what you're doing, what you're suggesting, and what we're trying to do is expose that argument. You know, one can get into a discussion about whether one should use the term sex or one should use the term gender. I mean, the fact of the matter is gender became a synonym for sex, but it's not a particularly accurate use of the English language. Gender was a grammatical term that applies to words. It doesn't apply to people. And we started using that to apply to sex in kind of a lazy way. But it doesn't imply at all that sex is this sort of this internal psychological construct. That doesn't follow at all. And you're right. For someone to say that that issue is just settled is just blowing smoke.
Now
I think wondered what I thought.
Now I think we have had our final question. So at this point, let me give you a minute or two to express any final thoughts you might have, Kyle Duncan.
No, I really don't have much else to say. I do appreciate the opportunity to do this. This is a very interesting and important case, and I'm grateful to be able to represent the school board in this case. Maybe I should say this in summing up. Is my client, I'm very proud to represent my client in this case, the Gloucester County School Board, because they, when faced with a difficult situation, they acted with a great deal of compassion and sensitivity. They allowed the student who was going through some problems, they allowed the student to have the student's name changed in school records. They got together with the student's teachers and said, look, this student wants to be referred to by male pronouns. They allowed the student to use a separate nurse's restroom so the student would be more comfortable. And even after this dispute arose, the school went out of its way to provide separate unisex restrooms for all students so that this particular student would not feel singled out. Yet none of that was enough. What the school board did in this case was to go well above and beyond what Title IX and its regulations require, but that wasn't enough. And now we have to go to the Supreme Court to work it all out, and I'm very hopeful that the Supreme Court will see this case the way that we see it, which is this is a straightforward case of statutory and regulatory interpretation, and that if people want the law to be changed to accommodate these new novel situations, we have to do it through Congress or at least through a notice and comment proceeding and not through a mid-level official writing an opinion letter. But thanks, Dean. I've enjoyed it, and I hope this has been enlightening for the callers.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I mentioned that we will like to be in touch with you as this case moves forward. Thanks also to the audience for their thoughtful questions. And a reminder to the audience to join our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at this same number at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.